WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two of the most fascinating memoirs to read side by side are The Duke of Deception by Geoffrey Wolfe and This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolfe. The two writers are brothers, but they grew up separately because when they were children, their parents divorced. Tobias lived with his mother, who was broke, and ended up getting involved with an abusive man. Geoffrey lived with his father, a Yale-educated man of refinement, who schooled his son in how to be a gentleman. But as Geoffrey later learned, his father really was a con man who had made up his credentials and his lineage. Geoffrey Wolfe, the older brother, is my guest today. He's the author of several novels. His new one, The Final Club, is loosely based on his own experiences as a student at Princeton University in the late 1950s. He describes the elitism and snobbery the students displayed toward each other. The example that was particularly devastating for Wolfe and his main character was Bicker. Bicker was the process by which the 20 eating clubs at Princeton chose new members. As an upperclassman, if you didn't belong to an eating club, you had no place to eat on campus.
At a time in the middle of the year, they suspended classes in order to have us interviewed, all of us, all sophomores, interviewed by upperclassmen in our rooms for 5 to 7 hours a day for 12 days. People would come and judge our livery, our haberdashery, our bona fides, our bloodlines, our agreeableness as potential eating mates, and they would gradually do a great winnowing, and they would find favor with some and find disfavor with others. Now, the way the system worked, almost everyone was asked to join an eating club. But at the end, there were between a dozen or perhaps 25 people who were pariahs, who were invited to dine in the town's restaurants rather than the eating clubs. And before I had a chance to be pushed, you might say, I jumped. So halfway through Bicker, I found this system so intolerable that I left the university for a year.
When you look back on the Bicker experience now, does it still seem as profoundly disturbing, or does it seem really less important?
It seems extraordinary to me. And the part that seems extraordinary to me is not that children, because that's what we were, it isn't that children are capable of that kind of cruelty to one another and that kind of stupidity to one another, but that the institution validated it, the institution allowed it, the institution suspended classes in order to make it happen. I mean, all of this has changed now. I mean, now there is such a thing as Bicker, but only a handful of people play that game, and so it's all right. I don't care if a handful play it. It's when the whole mess of us had to that is so extraordinary. I find it profoundly disturbing that an institution that I loved, and I say that with a certain understanding that it's hard to love institutions today in the year 1990. Not many people love institutions, but in the year 1956 and in the year 57 and 58, we loved that institution. A lot of us did, and that the institution that we loved somehow betrayed us with this horrible system it had invented.
I'd like to give our listeners a sense of what it was like for you growing up, and I'm not quite sure how to do it except for to ask you briefly to tell a really complicated story, which is maybe to just sum up some of the disguises your father used over the years and who he really was.
My father represented himself as a very well-educated man, and I mean, so well-educated that he represented himself as having a degree in aeronautical engineering from the Sorbonne, which is, of course, a school of the humanities, has no aeronautical engineering degree anyway. His ambition in the beginning, I believe, was to impress his father, who was a surgeon and very hard to impress. And then he tried to impress others, and the process of trying to impress others was always self-aggrandizement. He claimed to have been a war hero, for example, in ways that were awfully hard to reconcile, because he claimed to have parachuted in among the Yugoslav partisans at about the same time he was flying with the Flying Tigers over Burma. His process always was engorgement. I mean, he had huge appetites, and he was a person who said, just a little bit too much is just enough for me, for example. He was, I suppose, what you'd call clinically a psychopath, in the sense that he seemed to have no moral conscience. He'd write bad checks in a restaurant, but he always tipped in cash. He knew how to take care of the help. He was immensely charming. He was witty. He was well-read. He was very quick. He was very smart. He was very warm. He was a crook, and he spent the last years of his life in prison.
But when you were growing up, you didn't know any of this.
No. When I was growing up, he was a hero, and I idolized him, and I idolized him probably for the right reasons. I idolized him because of his warmth and his wit and his unfailing attention to me. He was a very loving man. He had many friends. And so the particulars of his curriculum vitae were all unknown to me, and at that time of no interest to me. So in an odd way, I could say that I had a happy childhood, except when he was away, which was a lot of the time.
How did the masks get taken off?
Well, a lot of them get taken off when a son or a friend begins to become acute enough to see that things aren't matching up, that they don't make any sense. He got caught. Well, he rose to the august position of assistant chief engineer at Boeing at the time they were building the XB-52. And because he had to have atomic clearance for that, it was after the war, it was I think 1949, 1950, he got caught by the FBI. And the FBI traced back all his job resumes. And job resumes were okay. They tracked back. He'd worked for North America and he'd worked for Northrop. But all of a sudden, they tracked him back to the Sorbonne. That all of that monkey shines with the Sorbonne and the Yale and Groton, and he hadn't even been born where he said he was born. He liked the idea of having been born in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York. So, at about the year 1937, which was a rather potent year, he fell off the face of the earth to the FBI, And I'm here to tell you, they were very upset by that.
So did you learn about this through the FBI?
I learned some of it when the FBI came to visit our house in Seattle. And I remember how nice they were. I mean, how kind and gentle they were, the FBI agents. In fact, they told me that they'd like me to leave the room, and they were extremely polite, courteous to my father. And when they left, for the first time I saw him deeply shaken. But at the same time, you know, by then, the circumstances of our life had been so erratic. We'd lived high life and low. We'd lived in horrible rooming houses and in antebellum mansions. We had lived off the cuff. We had lived in the Ritz-Carlton, and we'd lived in a cold water walk up in Niagara Falls. We'd lived all over the place. So by the time this happened, and I was 14 years old, I didn't know what to expect anymore, ever. And that seemed all natural to me, because we take the extraordinary in our lives almost for granted in an odd way. I think all children do that.
Did you ever talk to your father and confront him with the truth of his identity?
I did it twice in particular. The first time, I will never forget. I'd grown up with the last name that I have, Wolf, and as it happens, my father's father was a Jew, and my father's mother was a Jew. As it happens, my father's father was a Jewish atheist. My father represented himself as an Episcopalian and absolutely denied his Jewishness. So he absolutely denied mine as well. And at a time when I was at the Choate School, I'd spent some time looking in the mirror. And I said, boy, that certainly looks like a Jewish boy to me that I'm looking in the mirror at. And I remember asking my father for about the third time, I said, am I Jewish? And I remember him becoming extremely exasperated in a very calculated and in a very very effective manner. And he said, for God's sake, he said, you know me. Am I an anti-Semite? And I said, no, you're not an anti-Semite. And he said, then why in the world would I lie about being a Jew? Why in the world would I lie about such a thing? And at that moment, my choices were binary. I either had to disbelieve him about everything that I knew, or I had to believe him. And it was a horrible and unforgivable thing that he did to me that day. And, of course, I won't forget it. The other time I confronted him is by writing a novel called Bad Debts, in which I wrote what turned out to be a cartoon version of him, a kind of a caricature version of a con man. And I sent him that book shortly before he died. At the same time, he was stone broke. He'd just gotten out of prison. He had some Social Security, and he was getting checks from me every month. And after he read that book, Bad Debts, he stopped cashing the checks, which is the most extraordinary thing of all the extraordinary things I know about him.
So, have you gone through an incredible identity crisis, so to speak, or do you just accept you are who you are?
I'm a writer, so all of life is an identity investigation, but it's not a crisis in the sense that, I can't judge myself. I can't judge what psychological damage all this has done to me, if any. I can say it's been great material for me as a writer.
That's really true. And part of that material is in your memoir, The Duke of Deception, which is a book about your father. Well, we've been talking about lies that your father told when you were growing up. Did you ever do a lot of lying yourself when you were young?
Oh, when I was a kid, I sure did. For one thing, I used to lie about him. I remember when we lived in Sarasota, Florida, and I lived there with my mother, and my father was, in fact, in Turkey as an engineer. And I used to tell people down on the pier, all these old geezers, these retired people down on the pier in Sarasota, I'd tell them that he was a trapper in the Maine woods, that my dad was a trapper in the Maine woods, and that he had an Irish setter that he lived in a cabin with, and that I was soon going to join him up there. I was a storyteller back then, and I'm a storyteller now, but now I get paid for it.
you credit Richard Blackmore, the poet, who was one of your teachers at Princeton, with showing you that you could tell the truth in your own language and make that a really interesting form of fiction, that you didn't have to fabricate a different self for your voice as an author.
Well, that's the other side of Princeton, and it's a side of Princeton that I don't want to neglect for a moment, and it's a side of Princeton that is prominent in The Final Club, and that is the great inspirational moments that a lot of teachers gave us there. An encouragement to find our own voices. The first time we were treated as though we were adults.
I want to get back to the idea of writing in your voice as opposed to in a false voice. I'm reminded of a letter that you wrote when you were in college that you reprint in The Duke of Deception, your memoir about your father and growing up with him.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a letter that you wrote after trying to feel up and make it with a girl who you were out with. And so the letter reads like this. Had a great time with my mater in D.C., dined at the Mayflower. Plenty of nook up here in Maine. Went the distance last night with that babe from Walker's. Huge, Hooters, hot. Wheeled around in her old man's car, told him I had a license, scored in the back seat. Of course, not only isn't that the kind of language you were probably talking in at the time, maybe it was, it doesn't sound like the kind of language you use now, but a lot of that wasn't true, like scoring in the back seat. What's that an example of to you?
Alas, it wasn't true at all.
Yeah.
Alas, I didn't score in the back seat. What that's an example of to me was a trying on of voices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it brings, you've certainly made my ears go red. I'm blushing as I hear it. At the same time, I recognize in it an important truth about what writers do, is that in order to find the one voice that can belong to us, we try on a lot of voices that don't. And that is the process. It is, alas, a glacial process of discrimination. I found a voice that seems to belong to me when I wrote The Duke of Deception, which was my fifth book, and it took that long. The problem now sometimes is when I write fiction is getting rid of that voice that belongs to me and taking on the voices of my imagined characters. Sometimes my voice leaks in. Sometimes my voice leaks into places where it shouldn't leak in.
Writer Jeffrey Wolfe is my guest, and his new novel is set at Princeton. It's called The Final Club. Let's bring up the subject of your brother, Tobias Wolfe, who's also a writer now. And when your parents separated, he went with his mother, you went with your father. And as you were growing up, sometimes living the high life, sometimes living the low life, he was growing up in a near broke atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to come east where you were living to get away from his mother's abusive lover. He wanted to go to a boarding school and was hoping that you would help to get him in. And you did. I was wondering if you ever gave him advice on how to behave in a more middle-class kind of environment, the kind of environment he was about to enter.
Oh, poor baby, did I give him advice? Oh, did I give him advice? I gave him advice till it came out his ears. And that advice now, I mean, he and I spend a lot of time laughing at that advice. I taught him manners, but I also, I remember we had this extraordinary summer together in La Jolla, California. My father had a nervous breakdown. He was in a mental hospital, in fact, and my brother and I hadn't seen each other for, I think it was almost 12 years, and it was just before he went to the Hill School, and I just graduated from Princeton, and he didn't have a job. He was a little kid. He was 15. And so I was supporting us at the time. And I remember every day before I went off to work, I'd make him read a book, a whole book, and write an essay about it every day. I mean, I had this absolute power over him, and I exercised it. But he wrote for that summer every single day an essay, and every single day he read one of the great books that I assigned to him. And it was a horrible abuse of power on my part, but at the same time, I don't regret it now for a moment, and I'm not sure he does either.
You know, I'm sure a lot of people see you and your brother almost as this peculiar science experiment. What happens if two brothers are separated, live in completely different kinds of environments, in different social and economic classes, and then meet as young adults, you know? And now you both ended up as writers. You both ended up writing memoirs about growing up and about growing up with your parents or with your parent. it's really kind of remarkable. And I wonder how much you think is genetic.
Well, I don't know how much is genetic. He finds it less remarkable than I do. As a matter of fact, we had a conversation about this issue this morning. We talk almost, I suppose we talk 3 or 4 times a week. And we spent most of our time laughing. But we were talking about this very question: how remarkable is it that we both write? And he finds it utterly unremarkable. He said, it's as unremarkable as saying two people have blonde hair, for example. I find it remarkable. So here we divide on it. Because he can't imagine, as I can't imagine, doing anything other than what we do, he can't find anything remarkable in it, I think.
What surprised you most when you read your brother's memoir about growing up, this boy's life?
I'd always known he was smart. I didn't know that he was a genius. It's an extraordinary book. In an odd way, I found myself reading his book and forgetting he was my brother. He became a character apart from me. I mean, a character with absolute integrity. Part of it, of course, was extremely sad. Part of it was scarifying to me to see how unhappy he had been at times. But after I'd finished the book, I realized that what he had done in his book was a thing I'd tried to do in my book too, was he had brought back alive and intact the whole complexity of what we call an unhappy childhood, that it isn't just monolithically unhappy, that it's complicated, very complicated, that there are parts of it that aren't unhappy at all. There are parts of it that are characterized by laughter and by singing and by friendships and by love and affection. And there isn't such a thing, or at least in my experience, and I think I can say in his, as a childhood that is simply unhappy.
Since you and your brother are pretty close now and you're both writers, are there ever territorial concerns over who owns a certain story that you share?
I think there have been in the past. That's ancient history, and it's also comic history. That's the kind of thing we wind up laughing about. There used to be a time, for example, when I'd call him and tell him a story, and I'd say, "You can't use this. This is mine." And sometimes he'd do the same thing. We don't do that anymore because we don't have to. Also, we don't tell stories like that anymore in print. In other words, the neat anecdote, the joke, or something doesn't find itself into print quite as frequently as it used to in the bad old days with us. But the subject of who owns what now is a subject of high comedy, or I should say, low comedy for us.
Do you feel that you're very good now at telling who lies, at spotting someone who is a con themselves?
Sure, but I used to be obsessed with lying. I used to be obsessed with lying and the truth, and I don't care about it so much anymore. I have two sons, and when they were first growing up, I used to tell them horribly. You'd sort of enjoin them always to tell me the truth, son, never lie to me, quite solemn about it. And of course they didn't. I mean, they lie the way all kids do about all kinds of things that they don't think I should know, and they're absolutely right, I shouldn't know them. And so I've got a good laissez-faire attitude toward the whole thing now. But can I spot a phony? I think yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and about writing. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been writer Jeffrey Wolfe. His new novel is called The Final Club. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.